Okay, well, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Sue Stokes from Yale University. Professor Stokes is the John S. Seddon Professor of Political Science and the director of the Yale Program on Democracy. Sue has written many works on democratization processes in Latin America, and her most recent book is entitled Democracy and the Culture of Skepticism, Political Trust in Argentina and Mexico, which I found very interesting. And her book, Mandates in Democracy, was the recipient of several Best Book Awards by various political science associations. So it's our great pleasure and to welcome Professor Stokes here. I'd like to thank the Center for Latin American and Iberian Studies for their generous support of the speaker series. And thank you all for turning out on a Friday afternoon. It's lovely weather outside, and you chose to be here. So this kind of shows to the rest of the world what a vibrant academic community we have here at Vanderbilt. And that's part of the purpose of this lecture series. So I'm very happy to have you here. And without any further ado, I'll hand it over to Sue. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John, and thanks. And I thanks also to Mitch Seligson and to the Center on Latin American and Iberian Studies and the Political Science Department for the invitation. When I left Hartford Airport yesterday, I think it was about 35 degrees and everything was brown, and so it's very nice to get a little blast of high spring as well as to be able to speak with you all. So thanks very much. The cover story of The Economist magazine screamed backlash in Latin America. The basic storyline of the accompanying article was that Latin American leaders were both slashing budgets. To quote the article, fiscal discipline has slashed the average budget deficit by two-thirds, and opening their countries to free trade. The article wrote, protectionist barriers have tumbled. Yet frustration with slow pace of growth was leading to a backlash. The evidence of this backlash, according to the article, came in the form of guerrilla movements in Mexico, hand-wringing by leaders like Eduardo Frei of Chile at the slow pace of reform and the growing restiveness of domestic electorates, and the plummeting popularity of neoliberal leaders such as Alberto Fujimori of Peru and Carlos Menem of Argentina. Now, it's probably hard to make out from the slide, but the publication date of that article was November 1996. 10 years later, as you well know by this point in the lecture series, in 2006, presidential elections were held in Brazil, Ecuador, Mexico, Colombia, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Peru. Leftist candidates won in Brazil, Ecuador, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, and barely lost in Mexico. One might also add the election of Oscar Arias from Costa Rica's PLN party, sort of traditional social democratic party, although Arias himself had implemented neoliberal kinds of policies in an earlier term. One might also mention Alan Garcia's election in Peru. Garcia of the APRA party defeated a more clearly rightist candidate in the first round of the elections and came in second. APRA is a traditional kind of left populist party, although Garcia's own discourse in that election campaign was decidedly more centrist. Now, these leftist leaders joined Michelle Bachelet of Chile and Evo Morales of Bolivia, both elected in 2005, and Tabaré Vázquez of Uruguay, elected in 2004. Together, they formed the Pink Tide, now lapping the shores of Latin America. Webster's Dictionary defines the term backlash as, quote, a sudden violent backward movement or reaction. Does the rise of the electoral left in Latin America represent a backlash against neoliberalism? And should we think of their challenge to neoliberalism as a backward movement, a reaction? In my remarks today, I'll suggest that the answers to both questions are no. To understand why, we have to interpret recent developments, an apparent rejection of neoliberalism, and the electoral successes of the left in the region against a broader backdrop. Now consider the following stylized fact. In most of the world, when countries open their economies to trade, they also tend to increase social spending. That is, big states and open trade go together. In Latin America, since redemocratization, as countries opened their economies to trade, the public sector either remained stagnant or even shrank. These, by world standards, contradictory trends opened up what I'm going to call a welfare gap. Third stylized fact, among the reasons why the electoral left has fared well in recent elections is that citizens viewed the left as an instrument for closing the welfare gap and thus reducing economic risk. Fourth stylized fact, but when the left itself is seen as risky, it doesn't benefit from the opening of the welfare gap. I'll try to persuade you that the current good fortune of the left across the continent is in no small part a delayed response to excessive neoliberal zeal in the first two decades after democratization. My basic claim is that we are witnessing not a moment of backlash, but a moment of re-equilibration, with popular and partisan forces pushing to close the welfare gap, for a return to a more, if you will, natural balance between globally integrated economies and large states. Let me give you just a couple of quotes from leftist leaders from the region, left-centered leaders from the region, that are suggestive of a kind of drive toward compensating for neoliberalism rather than reversing it. You can see here Néstor Kirchner, president of Argentina. Trade agreements should contain safeguards and compensations for those who suffer relative setbacks so that the agreement will not increase their weaknesses. And the almost president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, in 2005, we don't want to settle for NAFTA. We want to think in terms of Mexico's development in order to improve living conditions in the country. So he's not saying we want to get rid of NAFTA. He's saying we don't want to settle for NAFTA. We want to improve living conditions. So let me begin by reviewing the evidence regarding our first stylized fact. In the 70s, scholars began to notice that countries heavily exposed to trade also tended to have large public sectors. Here are a few important references for this literature. A seminal piece was by David Cameron. He analyzed the relationship between trade openness and public sector size in OECD countries. And later studies then extended these results to a broader array of countries, a broader set of countries, and broader periods of time. They showed that the open trade big state relation held up in the presence of all kinds of statistical controls. So you might think that there are other things that cause both countries to be open to international trade and to have large public sectors. But even in the presence of controls for those other potential confounds, the relationship holds up. And it generally held up whether state size was measured in terms of total government spending, government revenues, spending on social security, health or education, or on government consumption. Now, why do states that are integrated into the world economy tend to have large public sectors? The basic explanation goes something like this. Globalization, the integration of world markets for goods and labor, and capital, I should add, tends to increase the volatility of people's welfare. For instance, low-skilled workers will tend to face more volatile employment prospects and wages when markets are integrated. State spending works as a kind of insurance policy against this volatility. Unemployment insurance, pensions, public works all have the effect of smoothing the ups and downs that people face as their countries come increasingly integrated into the world economy. So let me give you a little flavor of some of the evidence that has been marshaled in to demonstrate this relationship between integrated trade and large states. Danny Roderick, a Harvard economist, in a book that I cited here, developed a measure of external risk, the external risk that countries face, which he describes as the volatility of the streams of income associated with fluctuations in the external terms of trade. And he shows that the more a country is exposed to external risk, the more variable are its domestic economic conditions. The greater the variability of real GDP, of consumption, and the like. Roderick then shows that the more external risk a country faces, the larger are its government expenditures. This is a slide from his book that gives you, you know, one of a number of kind of analyses that he presents. And you can see the horizontal axis is a log of trade openness, the vertical axis a log, in this case, of government consumption. And there's a fairly, and I should say this is a partial correlation. This is already controlling for a number of other factors. And you can see that there's a fairly tight and visible positive relationship between the degree of openness of trade and the size of the public sector. In fact, Roderick distinguishes empirically between the risk that a country faces and the degree of trade openness, and controlling for risk, trade openness no longer makes a difference. So it seems that it's really the risk that comes with the opening of trade, the ups and downs, the volatility of domestic economic outcomes that seems to be driving the increased size of the state. If large states are insurance policies against the risk that comes with open trade, then we should expect democratic countries to be more responsive to demands for insurance. That is, if an opening of trade brings greater volatility and risk to people's welfare, and people in response demand that government policy protect them from this risk, then we should observe a difference in the behavior of democracies and dictatorships when they open to trade. And in general, we do observe such a difference. Adsera and Boyce, in the article that I cited a moment ago, undertake an analysis like Roderick's, but they pay attention to whether the government in question is a dictatorship or a democracy. And you can see that this is actually a simulation based on their analyses. And you can see that both authoritarian regimes and democracies tend to grow, the state tends to grow, as trade becomes more open, but the effect is stronger among democracies. And this is a nice kind of confirmation of the underlying mechanism of people pushing, citizens pushing more effectively in democracies than in dictatorships for protection from risk. So to summarize where we are so far, I hope I've convinced you of the first stylized fact: in the world, open trade goes with big states. Let me now turn to the second stylized fact, which is that the open state trade, big states link is severed in Latin America. At about the time that researchers like Roderick started to revisit the issue of state size and trade openness, Latin America seemed to be moving in the opposite direction. Country after country was opening its trade at the same moment that it was downsizing the state, privatizing state-owned enterprises, reducing the staffs of government ministries, and even in some cases privatizing basic social services, basic public services. So many of us Latin Americanists were left scratching our heads. We read excellent studies proving that open trade leads to large states, but observed one country after another in Latin America simultaneously opening trade and downsizing the state's involvement in the economy. Even more puzzling was the fact that Latin America's anomalous trends took hold just as many Latin American countries were democratizing. At the very moment, at the very moment when Latin American governments should have been becoming more responsive to popular pressures for economic protection, these governments seem to be taking their countries in the opposite direction, liberalizing trade and at the same time reducing the public sector. Our impression that that the open markets big state equation didn't describe the trend for Latin America was confirmed a few years ago by an excellent article by Bob Kaufman and Seguro Viergo, who found a strong negative effect of trade openness on social spending in Latin America. The opening of trade depressed Social Security transfers in particular, whereas spending on health and education were somewhat more resilient. And to give you a sense of the magnitude of the effects that they discovered, they write that a 10% increase in long-term trade between 1973 and 1997, which is the period that their study covered, produces an average decrease of over $31 per capita in social spending, which is over 10% of the regional average of $255. So not a negligible effect. So a couple of pictures can make these trends more vivid. I apologize that my economic data that I'm going to be presenting end in 97. I'm working on updating, trying to match the Kaufman and Segura Ubiergo data set, but haven't quite gotten it smoothed out yet. This is a picture of Mexico. It shows a growing involvement in trade beginning all the way back in the late 70s, accelerated enormously after the North American Free Trade Agreement was implemented in 94. But over this same period, you can see the bottom line is social spending, and it really doesn't budge. If anything, it dips a bit in the 80s, but basically does not move. Here's another picture. This is Chile. What you can see is that globalization sort of gallops ahead in the 80s after the debt crisis, which hit Chile very hard, social spending languishes. Indeed, in these same years, it falls. I confess I was surprised by this picture. I thought that the Democratic governments had done more to close the welfare gap than they actually had after 1990. Now, you're probably asking yourselves, why has Latin America gone in the opposite direction from the world trend? Kaufman and Segura Ubiergo underscore the balance of power between domestic business interests and organized labor in their explanation. They also mention the ideological convictions of Latin American economic reformers who were in power in many countries during this period. A 2006 paper by Eric Wibbles focuses more on pressures from international capital markets and financial institutions in constraining Latin American governments to keep the state small at the same time that they're liberalizing trade. Now, these explanations make perfect sense. But I want to suggest a deeper explanation, which is that what we have observed in Latin America over the past 20 years, culminating in the pink tide, may be pretty typical of the political processes that lie behind the open trade big states connection in the rest of the world. The re-equilibration and closing of the welfare gap may be happening more slowly in Latin America than it has in Europe, probably for the reasons that I've just cited. But the process is probably not unlike what's happened elsewhere. Indeed, we may have misinterpreted the political dynamics of the open trade, big states relationship in the advanced industrial economies. Here again is the figure from Roderick's book showing how countries array themselves across the two dimensions of trade openness and state size. Roderick has drawn a regression line through these points. Notice that the regression line is simply the line that minimizes the sum distance between itself and the actual observed locations of countries at any given point in time on the coordinate plane. It tells us nothing about the trajectory that individual countries have traveled over time. Yet this kind of depiction leaves the impression that the actual historical road which many countries have taken from closed economies and small states to open economies and big states is smooth and upward sloping. The process appears to entail a simultaneous decision that countries take to open trade and to compensate people for the increased risk they face by expanding the insurance functions of the state. And in fact, Roderick himself falls into this interpretation occasionally, writing, for example, of simultaneous expansion of trade and governments in the post-war years in the OECD countries. But we want to run a risk in confusing the regression line with the actual path the countries have followed. I want to argue that this path has not been so much a line as a step function. Consider a hypothetical country which at an early stage in its national development is closed off from international trade and has a small public sector. Something happens, there's a shock in the international economic system or some sort of domestic changes, and those shocks induce greater integration with the country with international markets. The economy opens, it shifts to the right along the x-axis here. Yet this opening then brings about a lot of volatility in employment and wages, and people militate for a larger protective state. Especially if the country is a democracy, the government eventually responds by enlarging its role in the economy, and there's then a shift upward along the vertical dimension. Hence, if I'm right, the path to large states is not a smooth upward sloping one, but a step function. And what's interesting about the Roderick study, which is a wonderful, wonderful book, is that the data analysis actually incorporates the notion that's closer to a step function. He actually uses significant lags to estimate the effect. So what he's actually doing is looking at the effect of an opening of trade in the 1960s, for example, on state size in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. But that massaging of the data doesn't then work its way into his interpretation of this path, which in, I would say, fairly typical economic sort of thinking is a kind of equilibrium instantaneous shift simultaneously along to both dimensions. Latin America offers some evidence of a step function. In the later 1990s, there was some movement in the aggregate toward increasing social spending after the earlier period of retrenchment in the 1980s, though not enough to make the continent appear to abide by the open trade big state rule. Kaufman and Segura Ubiergo note that after the fiscal crisis of the 1980s, social spending within Latin America as a whole rose substantially during the 1990s. Let me talk for a second about Uruguay as a country in Latin America that illustrates some aspects of the step function that I've been talking about. You can see here that trade jumped after 1983 and stabilized later at a higher level than it had been earlier. Social spending dipped in the late 80s, but then grew fairly steadily in the next decade. And in fact, by the late 90s, it's achieved a level that far surpasses the levels that we saw, for example, when I showed you the pictures from Chile and Mexico. This slide, I have to say, I worked extremely hard to make it as illegible as it is. If you could see it, you still probably would have a hard time figuring out what's going on. But basically, what I've done here is try to collapse those two dimensions, those two lines from the previous slide into one line that is like a connect the dots thing, where each dot is identified by the year. And it's very hard to see, but what it I think shows is a complex path, obviously, with trade trending up in the late 1980s, while social spending didn't move much. Then social spending increased in the 1990s, while trade stayed more or less stable. This slide simplifies the kind of the effect. What I've done here is simply taken averages of both dimensions. So the point at the far left identifies the average trade per GDP and the average social spending for GDP from 73 to 79. The next point over is the same average for the 1980s. And then the final point at the end is the average for the 1990s. Now, I guess, you know, step functions are in the eyes of the beholder, but it's beginning to look a little that way. And if I cheat and take out 1982, which was an anomalous year because of the debt crisis, and there was a big sort of decline in trade as a function of GDP, just because GDP declined precipitously. Take that out, and what you see is a strong shift in the direction of trade liberalization, followed by an upward shift in social spending. So there's your step function. So we get outlines of a step function for Uruguay. Now, why did Uruguay begin to look like a step function when other countries didn't? Well, I don't really know, but it could have to do with the strength of the left actually going back well before the emergence, the victory of Vasquez in the 2004 elections. The his party and coalitions began to take, you know, solid 20-30% of the vote in earlier periods, and that may have accumulated as a kind of political pressure, may have represented a kind of political pressure to increase social spending earlier than happened in other Latin American countries. So to take a step back, what I'm suggesting to you is that the rise of the electoral left in Latin America may reflect the early dynamics of the step function. Most countries have shifted sharply to the right along the x-axis with the opening of trade. The arrival of the left may mean that we'll now begin to see more of a re-equilibration, a shift upward along the x-axis of social spending. Whether the Uruguayan path along the step function foretells the future of other countries is hard to say. But the pressure to do so is certainly there, as reflected in Latin Americans' choices in the voting booth. I'll put Mexico up there again to provoke John. This is a more typical picture, which you saw some of before. The Mexican story of the turn to neoliberalism is probably fairly familiar to many of you. Beginning with the De La Madrid administration in 1982, and in the wake of the default which set off the debt crisis in the 1980s, Mexico's ruling PRI shifted economic policies toward trade openness and liberalization. The globalization of the Mexican economy accelerated even more after Mexico entered NAFTA. At the same time, Mexico's social spending barely budged, and so, you know, here's your welfare gap. This was roughly the same time that the electoral left began to gain ground in Mexico, as did the PRI's principal opponent, the rightist PAN. This figure I've just put on percentages of the vote going to leftist parties in the proportional representation part of congressional elections in the lower house in Mexico. Of course, one needs to take Mexican electoral results with a big grain of salt, especially for earlier periods. Nevertheless, what we can see is a growing strength of the left in this period. Andrés Manuel López Obrador's near victory in last summer's presidential election is, I think, a natural outgrowth of this trend. So what this picture shows is that Mexico has moved far toward the right on the x-axis of free trade while not moving basically at all on the y-axis. Had a small number of votes gone in the other direction in last summer's election and the left won the presidency, I'd be more ready to predict that the growing strength of the left shown here would represent a 90-degree shift in the step function. But given the Uruguayan experience, I'm also willing to say that even out of power, a strengthened social movement pushing for kind of equalization and protection from NAFTA-induced volatility may have an effect on government policy, even when the sort of representative parties are in opposition. My theory of the rise of the left helps make sense of the Latin American anomaly of trade integration going not with big states but with small states. My basic claim is that we're witnessing a moment in which, having traveled rather far to the from left to right on the horizontal direction, a natural re-equilibration is underway, with popular and partisan forces pushing for a concomitant shift toward a risk-reducing state. Far from a backlash, what we are witnessing is a re-equilibration or a regression to the norm of larger states. If I'm right, and the current good fortune of Latin American left has something to do with trade integration and economic volatility, then it should be true that people who are risk-averse tend to support leftist candidates. Let me show you some evidence that this is true. Consider the case of Argentina in the last presidential election in 2003. Here are the candidates. This was a moment of kind of disarray in the Argentine party system. There are three candidates running simultaneously who were Peronists. In a non-pooling system, this is not a good sign for a political party. Menem, a kind of center-right candidate. I say center-right because his previous administrations were marked by neoliberalism and economic kind of turn to the market. Kirchner is a kind of center-leftist character. And then Adolfo Rodriguez Sá, the fourth candidate down here, is another Peronist from with a strong regional base in the province of San Luis. The conservative candidate was López Murphy, and then there was a more decidedly left candidate named Elisa Carrió from a party called the Alternativa para una República de Iguales, or ARI, and she was sort of clearly a more leftist candidate. Kirchner, I should say, did have good sort of left or center-left credentials. He had been a member of a radical Peronist youth organization during the military proceso or dictatorship of the 1970s. His policy stances were in fairly stark contrast to Menem's. Menem's economic policy proposals continued to be sort of right of center and neoliberal. Kirchner's spoke a lot about economic protection and job creation. Kirchner ended up winning 22% of the vote behind Menem, and Menem decided not to run in the second round of balloting, and Kirchner became president. And once in office, Kirchner, if anything, shifted more decidedly to the left. Two Argentine colleagues and I conducted public opinion surveys in Argentina in July of 2003, a few months after the election. We asked people how they'd voted, and we also asked several questions that were aimed at getting at their attitudes towards risk. So economists in particular think of people's willingness to tolerate risk as a kind of an individual attribute, almost part of our psychological makeup. And we followed in addition of some researchers in Mexico, actually, in trying to develop survey questions that to measure those attitudes towards risk. So we asked people, we presented them with two aphorisms and asked them which one they agreed with more. Believe me, these sound better in Spanish than they do in English. Better in a bird in the hand than 100 flying. We have a similar one in English. Or he who doesn't take risks doesn't gain. We also asked, so that's sort of meant to get at a kind of generalized attitude toward risk. We also asked them whether they, a more kind of policy-related notion of risk, whether they thought that implementing new policies that hadn't been tried was necessary for progress or dangerous. And then we asked them a sort of more economically related question about risk, whether a good job is one which you don't make a lot of money, but it's secure and stable, or where you make a lot, but it's unstable. So since we asked these questions about risk, and we also obviously asked questions about how people had voted, I'm able to study the impact of risk aversion on the preference of voters for candidates of various ideological orientations. Let me add that it was very important to study the effect of risk simultaneously with looking at the effect of income, because we have theoretical reasons for thinking that people with low incomes are risk averse, and in fact, in our sample, that turned out to be true. People with low incomes, other things equal, tended to be more risk averse than people with higher incomes, and because we also have good reasons to think that people with low incomes, apart from their fears about risk and volatility, just for reasons having to do with transfers, prefer left candidates, we need to disentangle those two things by looking at them simultaneously. And what we found was that the center-left candidate, Kirchner, tended to have the support of poor people, particularly those who said that it was dangerous to implement untested policies. But the other leftist candidates, Carrillo and Rodriguez Sá, attracted support from risk-accepting people who thought that it was good to implement untried policies. So these positive means that a dummy indicating somebody who's risk-accepting, all else equal, had a higher probability of having voted for the candidate in question. So those are what I'm... The negative there, or positive, refers to the regression coefficient relating risk to the probability of voting for the candidate. So why... It looks here as though the center-left candidate gets risk-averse people's support, but not the far-left candidates. And what I want to suggest to you is that the finding is supportive of the proposition that increased volatility in the wake of trade liberalization helped the left, but risk-averse people were not more likely to support candidates who were further to the left, such as Carrillo and Rodriguez Sá. And this is probably because more far-left candidates are seen as risky propositions in other ways. And in this particular election, these particular candidates, it's not hard to see how they could be seen as risky propositions. Elisa Carrillo had never held executive office, and during her campaign, there was a big flap because her chief economic advisor, Ruben Lovuolo, in a press conference, basically said that he didn't know what they were going to do with the economy if they took office. Rodriguez Sá had plenty of executive experience. He had been the governor of San Luis province for many years, but he was briefly president of Argentina in December of 2001. And when I say brief, I mean brief. He was president for 7 days, and in that time managed to take Argentina into default on its debt. And his detractors like to point out that of those 7 days, 4 of them were bank holidays. So this achievement was in fact carried out in 3 days. So what I'm saying here is that after being exposed to the volatility of free trade and in the absence of a strong social safety net, many Argentines seemed to want the security of social spending, but they didn't want policy innovation. So a refined theory would go something like this. Trade integration induces risk. Risk makes people want a larger state to act as insurance. Parties and candidates that occupy center-left positions benefit from this increased volatility and increased demand for insurance. The candidates and parties farther to the left are themselves interpreted as risky and hence don't benefit. Or maybe a better way of saying it is when candidates of the left are interpreted as risky, they will not benefit from the increased volatility. And in future research, I hope to pursue this refined theory. Let me just end by emphasizing the essence of the argument that I've made here. As social scientists have rediscovered the link between open trade and big states in recent years, we've tended to efface the politics underlying this link. We've thought about it as the result of a simultaneous collective choices to open trade and to enlarge the state. We've confused the regression line for the path that states have actually taken, which is more of a step function. Trade opens, and only later, under pressure from the citizenry, does the public sector grow. We should bring this more accurate sense of the political dynamics of the open trade big states link to the current Latin American scene and in particular to the recent rise of the left around the continent. As is probably true in general, the recent globalization of Latin America predated an increase in the public sector. There's some evidence of a catch-up of social spending already. The step function has already begun to take shape in some places. Hence, the recent rise of the left in Latin America is not a backlash against neoliberalism, but a re-equilibration, a shift toward a more natural combination of free trade and big states. Thank you very much.